yeah, the in the active life of the city, it's true. We tend to forget that.
But can't focus on just that period of time. They had a significant presence prior to that.
Sure, we're not going to deny that that Jerusalem was central to Jewish life in the ancient world, although there are even disputes about what that means, right? How, like, for example, there's some historians who say that Jerusalem was not the big city under Solomon that is described in the Bible. In fact, was probably more like a small village, and that later generations read back into time in order to elevate the status of the city. So, but of course, as you get closer to the time period that we're talking about, especially, for example, in relationship to the Maccabean Revolt, clearly it had a central importance. And we can't deny that Judaism was a temple-based religion, and the only place you had could have the temple was Jerusalem. In fact, in the early periods, if you read through the Bible, at least if we take that at face value, there was competition. Shiloh, there were outposts in Egypt even. So, but the power elite managed to establish Jerusalem as the center of worship.
When the Assyrians conquered most of Israel, Jerusalem wasn't so significant that they weren't willing to just leave it.
Right, for example. Yeah. That's right. There you have another perspective in the 8th century BC when it was the Assyrians, they left Judea alone, and you know, the Jews managed to hold off for a little while till the Babylonians came roaring in later. Did you want to say something? I don't know.
We keep hearing and reading about how small ancient Jerusalem was. 1 square kilometer. You mentioned 0.6.
No, 0.9.
0.9.
I think he's saying 1.9, the guy that we heard last year.
According to my...
You said 0.9.
I have 0.9.
0.9 kilometers.
0.9 times 0.9.
0.9
square.
Yeah, in each direction.
0.9, 0.9. It's still only 1 square.
It's let's put it this way. It's small. Yeah. Okay. It's small. Okay. It's small.
Now, 1 square kilometer is a very small area. Because
not in Hebrew. Not in Hebrew. It's much larger.
It's very small. And you know, 1 million people, 10,000 people can't live in 1 square kilometer. Are there any other estimates of how large the city was in some time over these hundreds of years that we are discussing?
Well, that's a good question. When the estimates give tens of thousands that may have been killed, I think you could have tens of thousands, but you're also talking about...
Not in 1 square kilometer.
Well, you're talking about the region, not only Jerusalem, but in terms of the revolt was also in the Galilee, and it was in Jaffa, and it was in other parts. But
people probably filled up the city who were...
Well, people fled into the city, though.
The city was overcrowded.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have the statistics, and I don't know if we could ever get reliable statistics, but I think the question that you're asking is a question around how many people could live in that what was called Jerusalem. That's a good question. I don't have an accurate answer for you, but...
I read from Mark Twain. He said that at the end of the 19th century, 14,000 people...
How many?
14,000.
14,000.
But we are not sure that he's probably not talking about within the
wall. I think he is talking about the walled city. There wasn't anything yet. There was one Jewish community established in 1860. Peter,
I'm interested. I think it's wonderful what you did talk about history and memory.
It's 1896.
But memory today, we're learning, or neurobiology teaching, is that memory is not... Memories that we have are the memories of a memory. Then when we remember again, it's a memory of a memory of a memory, and so many times removed. So memory is very, very unreliable. You talk about the imaginary... idealized in Jerusalem.
But very motivating.
But very motivating, yeah.
What reminded me of that this is not a unique story, because you have these happening over and over again all over the world. I mean, you know, when the Serbs didn't want the Bosnians to become a nation, a separate country, that's because, I forget the name of the town.
Yeah, 600 years before.
Where they put it there that their nation was born, that the Serbian nation was born there, where it now becomes part, now it's part of Bosnia.
Same with Rome. I mean, they created an idea of history.
So it's not unique that one nation owns a piece of land and then another nation comes in, you know.
And tells a story about why it owns the land.
And the whole thing, you know, becomes different than from what reality really was.
Ofri and Bennett and Bruce?
If anyone who's been in Jerusalem, I don't know if you would agree with me, but it's a very beautiful location. And I think a lot is said in the literature about the beauty of Jerusalem and the surrounding hills. What is it, like 7 perfect hills surrounding it? Why was it, would you know, like, why was it chosen as a central place for Judaism? It's not a port city. It's up on the hills. Are there any thoughts about that?
From an economic perspective, it's actually a bad location, and from agriculturally, it's a wasteland. Judea, like if we're talking about in the ancient world, it was on the crossroads of certain trade routes, but Jerusalem itself was economically really dependent upon its hinterland. That's a good question. Why? I was actually looking a little bit. I did some research into the origins, and one of the things that's interesting is that the name itself, Yerushalayim, there are various theories about it. One is that it's really the name, the Shalayim part, is from a West Semitic god called Shulmanu or Shalim. And that the first part, it's like to found. Like it was a city originally that was created by the local inhabitants as a shrine to their West Semitic god called Shulim. Jewish tradition reads back into it and calls it as the foundation of peace, Yerushalayim Shalom. It's a good question. I don't, you know, how do we go back into the misty prehistory to figure out how this city grabbed the attention of its inhabitants? Bennett, Bruce, tell me your name again.
Bob. I was just saying one theory is this is a small group of people and there were huge power centers in the ancient world that they needed to contend with that were, you know, in the Fertile Crescent in Egypt, and they had to find some place where they could eke out a living, and it was very hard to do that on the main roads of power and a little bit off the beaten track.
Also up high,
yeah.
Defensively, maybe a good location.
So I wanted to talk about that piece you read at the very end, which makes a lot of sense to when you think about how historical memory generates so much conflict in that area. And yet at the same time, it's very troubling if the answer to that is the rejection of history, that doesn't really matter anymore. And is that just something, a thought that applies to this area? Or is that something that you have to extend, you know, globally? And if so, well, then what about the whole historical project and our memory of our background and our origins? It's very troubling at the same time.
Well, also, it's who can forget. You could say, let's forget that there was. We could imagine this. Well, look at us and with the Native Americans. Mm-hmm. How do we establish that places like New York, Boston, all of these, Philadelphia? Mm-hmm. Oh, there was nothing else there. You know, that's the way we live with it.
Yeah, I mean,
there was nothing. So the question becomes, you're asking, maybe Amichai is wrong. Maybe that's not the answer.
He doesn't say that it's not important, but what he says, let go. Come on. This is not, it's important, but not the most important
thing.
I heard
him saying it wasn't.
He says here,
but
it's not important. He does say. We would have to look at the real, at the Hebrew.
But I'm not sure if it's realistic.
He may be rhetorical.
Maybe what's right. Maybe what's more realistic is to say we remember, but we understand that the only way forward is not to hold on too tightly.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Right. And I think he's also saying that look at the man buying food for his family. He's the future, whereas the past is just the past.
The past is...
Oh, he's the present, actually.
Look also the future. You know, he's talking about his family, and you know, that's who's going to grow in Israel.
Bruce?
The last time I was in Jerusalem, I went to see some of the excavation that we've done at the bottom of the wall, going from standing, looking at the western wall, and at the very base of the foundations, there are tunnels that go off, I guess it's to the north. And when you talk about the, you know, the physical features or the physical structures that people have built, and we have all the different, you know, parties competing for sovereignty there have different memories, and you know, and the memories, the stories and the memories, you know, they don't mesh with each other. So every part of the power struggle there is to try to find some, you know, solid physical structure to pin those memories to. So it's like part of that is they're going, here's, you know, we have these stories, but here we're finding things, we're finding out what it was really like that we didn't have any hard evidence for. You know, here's one of the entrances into the gates, into the Temple Mount itself.
And do you think that can be helpful or potentially even more inflammatory?
It could go either way, but that's part of the struggle for the, you know, who's going to have sovereignty over what part of it. And they say in the, you know, who knows what the PA is letting them do on the other side of that wall.
Probably doing the same thing.
They're digging down, but, you know, the things that they find, they're going to tell us about some things, and they're not going to tell us about others, so we need to, like, dig fast over here, and, you know, that's part of the struggle going on, literally, beneath
the wall.
Beneath the wall.
It is fascinating, though, because to go back 2,000 years, it's not something that you can experience in this country.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
Bob, you want to say something?
Some of that you see all over, you know, all over Israel, wherever you go.
Bob?
2 points. So what I was going to say originally was just that it's the points where we're not allowed in Jerusalem. It's like that which you can't have becomes more valuable.
Whet your
so
appetite.
That was an experience that both the Jews and the Muslims had, but the Jews for much longer periods of time. And then another theory about why is Jerusalem where it is that some people speculate is because David was not wanting to empower one tribe over another, so he was looking for a high point that was not central to when any of the tribes were. That's one theory. I don't know if that can be confirmed.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Similar to Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Compromise.
Where it is as a compromise.
Mm-hmm. Right.
To not empower any of the states.
Doug?
Sarah? Two things. Just to observe. I'm always... the Western Wall is where I've been to Jerusalem a couple of times. And I've been to the tunnel underneath and everything, and they explained with a little model how it was built. The Western Wall is the bottom of a vast retaining system,
right,
that on top of which created a plaza big enough for all of these people to come from the hinterlands to celebrate. So And the retaining wall, when Daniel was bar mitzvahed, my son was bar mitzvahed, we went around the corner a little bit. There's an archaeological park there that allows men and women to be at the base of the retaining wall, so that we didn't have to separate the men from the women. The wall there is identical to the wall over there. There's the Herod stones, which have the...
Yeah, are you talking about Robinson's Arch?
Robinson's Arch, correct. But the Herod stones, which have their telltale, they have the border around them. Well, the other thing was that the other night I saw that movie,
Gatekeepers.
Thank you.
Gatekeepers, yeah.
And in it, they talk about... This is a movie that's basically interviewing, I don't know, half dozen or more former Shin Bet leaders. And they talk about a scheme that was actually was found out, and they were actually able to arrest I think around 17 people who were involved in this. But the scheme was to blow up, burrow under the Dome of the Rock and blow it up. And it's really cool because in one shot they actually show the inside of the Dome of the Rock. And it's there's a big old rock right in the middle of that dome. I mean, it's a regular rock, piece of a rock, you know, it's the top of that mountain or whatever. But they were going to blow it up in order to bring on the Messiah.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Okay?
The Messianic era, right.
You know, the crazy...
Yeah, there are people out there who believe in that, yeah. You herald the collapse.
There's part of the Christian peoplehood who also want this to happen because they want the world to come to an end so the Messiah can come again, et cetera, et cetera. And they were talking about how it's so, you know, from that moment on, they divided their forces, who they were looking at, Palestinians and Israelis. And if they ever do this, and they still want to do it, all those guys are out of prison, they're back, and they still want to do it. And they said, can you imagine what this would mean if they ever did this? I mean, there's billions and billions of Muslims in the world, not just over in the Middle East, but all over the world.
Yeah, like Jews.
It would be an implosion.
They'd be very upset.
So it's interesting to see how this city and its architecture continues to have, its architecture is so darn important, and these, you know, who owns the architecture is really important. Architecture creates memory, I think, a lot.
Well, that's what Pierre Nora, he called his book, Les Lieux de Mémoire, the locales of memory. Heaven.
So you were describing in great detail the conflicts that took place around the time of the Hasmoneans, the sort of infighting amongst the Jews of the time. Obviously makes us think about the Arab Spring and about what's happening in Syria and other places right now, you know, how people are, in some sense, are working towards a common end, the overthrow of a current regime, but they're going to kill each other in the process. I'm curious, what are the historical records that allow us that level, that extraordinary level of detail? Are there multiple sources
the Hasmoneans behaved?
For example, right.
Well, the sources that we have for that are in particularly from Josephus, who the Jewish antiquities.
Yeah.
He's the main one. But then you also have records, for example, regarding when the Romans start to get closer to that region. You have you have Roman records, but we don't have huge records. But they do have a lot of lists of who killed who among the Hasmoneans.
Really?
Oh yeah, it's definitely
enough of records that is corroborating.
Narrated.
Now about the Arab Spring, you can look at multiple newspapers and all kinds of things in order to sort of figure it all out. But
that's a good point. Where are all of these? I mean, I wasn't reading the primary history, but they've charted fairly well, especially when you get closer to the epoch when the Romans come in about the intrigues that went that happened at the Hashmonean court.
Mm-hmm.
I will double check that. Oh yeah, they have the names. First of all, it wasn't you have the books of the Maccabees,
mm-hmm.
which are considered pretty historically solid, even though they present a theological perspective. But even people who are really suspicious of when Jewish history, in terms of what we call history, begins, like they reject the idea that there was this magnificent King Solomon's temple and that there were all these folks that really existed, that this sort of the Hashmonean, they say, okay, from here on we can start finding corroboration. They have a lot of archaeological. They have medals. They're discovering more now. They have coins and things. But yeah, they do have the names of the Hashmonean clan and their descendants and what they did. They do.
Which I think all the research into the Dead Sea Scrolls has.
That's another
made
piece.
All of
right.
that, you know,
yes.
Increased
yes.
that a lot.
Thank you for that reminder. Mm-hmm.
Of course, what this whole thing also shows, how important it is to build and protect successfully. I mean, once you build it,
that's what the Zionists call, and some continue to call, whether we hate it or not, facts on the ground, the famous,
but you have to be willing to protect it, because the Dome of the Rock is being protected by those who wanted to be there, successfully being protected. I mean,
on the one hand, the political sovereignty of the State of Israel, but they have religious sovereignty, the Palestinian Authority, in how to take care of it and preserve it. Yeah, it's very messy, though. And people are probably getting tired. I wanted to get back to this notion, though, of the way that the destruction of the temple and then the sort of retreat from history that we see happening subsequently in many ways, whether this idea that we should on some level celebrate the fact that the temple was destroyed and that Jews were exiled, because if it weren't for that cataclysm, maybe there wouldn't be Judaism today. Is that something you buy, or do you reject it and say, I don't hold with that.
I thought that Christians should be celebrating that Jesus was crucified for the same reason. Yeah. There would be no Christianity.
It's interesting. I buy it, and there was a conference some years ago when Dalai Lama had to leave Tibet. And he met with a group of Jewish people, and he found the story of the way in which, having no home, they were able to survive, and that it actually, in his view, strengthened. It gave him hope that that the Tibetans would have the same.
Mm-hmm. Well, but to accept that the Judaism that we know and appreciate today is what it was at the time of the temple is just not true.
No, that's no. It definitely
it's
no. That
it's,
is
two,
that
it's two
is
different things.
That is absolutely true.
So to be grateful for the destruction, because what we are today wouldn't have existed, it's like we're so far removed from that. You know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't
built
know.
On, we've built on that opportunity. Creatively over many.
Okay, so that you might say that it points to, and I think this is an important takeaway from what you just said, it points to a tremendous resourcefulness
mm-hmm.
in among the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
That from this chaos of this experience, and then in far flung from Babylonia, where there was already a very significant Jewish population about which we know almost next to nothing, because after the first exile, when the majority of the population of the Babylonian exile, the Babylonians removed, especially all of the leadership and lots of others. They forced what do we call them now? Forced transfers of the population, right?
Yeah.
There were some peasant Jews, so to speak, regular folks who stayed there, but huge populations, especially urban Jews, were moved. We don't really know what was going on, but when the Persians allowed the Jews to go back to build the temple in the 6th century, most Babylonian Jews, now known as Persians, they didn't go. They did like we did when Israel, like they gave money. And it was out of that the temple was rebuilt. And in fact, there were conflicts with the Jews who had remained and the Jews like Ezra and Nehemiah who came back. There were conflicts between them around what does it mean to be a Jew? But what I think what we're looking at is in the destruction in 70, you had huge communities in Egypt, in Syria, in Cyprus, already in North Africa, because the Jews became part of the Roman Empire. And in Babylonia, which wasn't part of the Roman Empire. And so from this far-flung group, over the period of a couple of hundred years, emerges a scripture-based, book-based religion that manages to unify all of these groups that are spread out over different territories, different languages, different political systems.
Yeah, but I don't totally buy it. Maybe that's because of my Zionist background. Because if you look at the wealth of Jewish culture, it's still the Bible and the biblical narrative. That's what we've equipped to the world. Those are the universal stories that are still very alive today. And rabbinical Judaism, you know, maybe transformed it in many ways, like you said, into a more mobile religion and more mobile culture and so forth. But the richness of Judaism, including the ethical dilemmas of an Abraham, go back to pre-rabbinical.
But none of that was lost.
That wasn't lost, yeah.
No,
yeah.
No, it wasn't lost.
It was co-opted.
It wasn't,
yeah.
it wasn't
appropriated.
What Sarah was saying is it wasn't defined by place. That it wasn't that we lost the traditions or lost the story.
Mm-hmm.
It's the place.
Well, that so for example, you'll see that, I mean, the point that I'm trying to maybe press about is, so today, we all, for example, call, you know, and I discussed this with some of my colleagues, so when people refer to the Jewish homeland, do we really believe that for us, I mean, if you were born in Israel, that may be different, but what do we mean when we say it's our homeland? Because you don't have to go back pretty far historically for, I mean, now with Israel, with Israelis, you can go back 100, 150 years, but the extent to which we call it a homeland is, in what sense do we mean that? In what sense do we mean that? Like some, the same person who referred to this idea that we, Gershon Cohen, who was a former chancellor and a historian, who referred to this idea that in some ways we ought to be thankful for the destruction, he talks about Jewland, that Jewland is not a particular place. It's the set of stories and narratives and ways of understanding how to live and how we've lived wherever we live. He calls it Jewland. And so, you know, I think what maybe this is a good way to end and to turn to the next session, which I hope you'll be able to attend, is if rabbinic Judaism beginning in about, let's say, 200 of the Common Era until about the 1800s is the dominant teacher of what it means to be Jewish, with the arrival of Zionism and a notion of place returning in a real way, because remember the rabbis in general say no return until the Messiah comes. We can't hasten it. And then Zionism upends that and says we don't care about the Messiah, or religious Zionists say we're going to help the Messiah come by doing some of that work now. So we have to, how do we contend with this idea that we're still sort of claiming to be the heirs of a rabbinic tradition that puts the emphasis on book and time right? It doesn't say that space isn't important. No, space remains important, but that it's really no longer a religion that's defined by space. And now new emerging understandings of what it means to be Jew that are very much defined by space and by that space that we call home, the homeland. So it's something to think about. What does that mean for all of us as we understand what it means to have a Jewish identity? So we're in a time of where there's a lot of shift in that. Okay, so next time we'll get together.
Thank you.